Good morning. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the program, we'll be talking about labor's call for sharing prosperity in the new economy. And our guest is Amy Dean. She is president of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council in San Jose, California, the heart of Silicon Valley. If any place epitomizes the new economy, it is certainly the Silicon Valley, where something like 63 millionaires are created every day, I believe the last year is something on that order. At the same time, a lot of families in Silicon Valley are sharing one room to live in. There are a lot of people who are not making it in Silicon Valley and a lot of people who are. This kind of hourglass economy is what she spoke about last night as part of the Millicom lecture series at the U of I Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations. And we will talk with Amy Dean this morning on Focus 580 and also welcome your calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, your questions are welcome as well. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, if you match the letters with the numbers. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Let me just say something more about our guest. Amy Dean has been active in organizing hourly workers in California's Silicon Valley for some time, and she serves on a number of organizational bodies, including Working Partnerships USA, which she helped founded as part of the AFL-CIO organizing effort. She is part of the Community College Board of Governors, appointed by the California governor in California, and she has been working in San Jose, originally from Illinois. She's, in fact, a 1982 graduate of the University of Illinois. So, Amy Dean, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We often ask this question as a way to get started on the show, so I'll throw it out at you. Just how bad is it in Silicon Valley?
I think that there's a lot of good news and a lot of bad news. Yeah. The good news is that it's really this small economic region of the world is fueling the historic economic boom here in this country. And so on the one hand, it's good news in that we are creating massive prosperity for our country. The not so good news is that that prosperity is not being broadly shared. So I think it's a good story and it's a not so good story all at the same time. And what we need to figure out is how do we figure out new strategies for a more broadly shared prosperity.
The people not at the top end of the pay scale in Silicon Valley. I mean, there are reports that people are essentially living in garages. That that a lot of people aren't making a living wage.
One of the hallmarks of the new economy is the new way industry has restructured itself to be competitive. Because the basis of competition is innovation, it forces a firm to really outsource or externalize any practice that is not core and foundational to innovation. And so things like food service, janitorial, even things like marketing, advertising, even things like systems administration, technical writing, things that used to be internal to a firm are now all outsourced. As a result, there's much more mobility within the labor market and much more need for flexibility from the employer's perspective within the labor market, which puts downward pressure on wages and benefits. So while there is a lot of economic growth and prosperity, the basis for the firm to be successful has enormous implications on working people. It means more insecurity as you move from job to job. It means that our social insurance programs don't necessarily accommodate this kind of mobile workforce. And so even though we have a situation where the economy is up, increasingly that has less and less to do with the well-being of working families. It's really the qualitative nature of employment that is declining, not the question of whether there are jobs or not. The economic problems that working families in the Silicon Valley confront is not so much a consequence of economic decline, but rather rapid growth.
You spoke last night about this model of employment, and of course we see it elsewhere in the world, but Silicon Valley, perhaps, as I mentioned in the introduction, epitomizes this hourglass-shaped economic structure, sort of a model for the rest of the world in many ways.
Right. I think it's important that when we take a look at what's happening in Silicon Valley, not to treat it as though it's some aberration, but rather foreshadowing of what's to come in the rest of the post-industrial world. The new economy isn't just about new products and new technologies. It's about the new ways the firm has restructured itself to be competitive. And as a result of all the outsourcing and the networks of firms that make up an industry cluster, labor markets are increasingly mobile. As a result, as I said earlier, people don't have the same kind of support and security that they once had when they were connected to their employment. And so the way that the employment contract is being restructured as a consequence of the restructuring of the firm is something that I believe is foreshadowing of what's to come in other places and other economies. This is not unique to Silicon Valley. This is unique to the way American firms have to restructure to be competitive in a global economy.
How does this impact the social contract that we've had since the New Deal? I mean, the obviously, industrial organizations have for a long time been much more vertically integrated, and there's in the last 20 years or so, a radical shift away from that, as you say, outsourcing and sort of a networking of the way that the work gets done. What are the implications of that for the social contract?
Well, I think our old social contract finds itself in tatters as a consequence of the fact that our economic borders have shifted. No longer are we insulated. Are we a nation state that's insulated by borders, but rather we are integrated into the world economy. No longer is the firm perform all the functions under one roof, and we have webs of firms that create an industry cluster. And our cultural expectations have changed. I would argue that our notions of justice have changed dramatically over the last 50 years. By the year 2010, all new entrants, and over 90% of new entrants to the workforce, will be women, immigrants, and people of color. There's a much greater diversity of actors in the economy, and so reconstituting a consensus about what one should expect and what one should be rewarded for as a relationship to work has to be redefined. And so as a result, our old social contract is in tatters because our economic borders have changed, the firm has restructured, our cultural notions of justice have changed, and we really need to rethink a new social contract given the new rules of the economy.
Well, how do you go about that given the sort of the demands of the global competitive economy, as we hear so much rhetoric about, you know, that we have to be efficient and that companies have to essentially one of the heads of Intel put it, only the paranoid survive. You have to really, you know, sort of be cutthroat. And if that comes to hiring out the cheapest labor in the cheapest way you can possible, that's what a company has. I mean, it seems that that's the imperative, at least in the minds of the CEOs and the boards of directors.
Right. I mean, I think it's a great question. How is it we take these kind of big picture concepts about what needs to happen in the world to restore equity, and how do we bring that down to a day-to-day organizing strategy? And it's the question to answer. Let me first start out by answering the question by saying that there historically has always been a tension in this country between the forces of the market on the one hand and our values that we hold near and dear to our hearts on the other. And much of our political and economic debates have been around how you create a balance between those two so that we can create competitiveness and economic growth, but at the same time create stability and permanence for people. That was the essence of the New Deal, allow firms to be competitive and yet keep people connected to the workforce. And then in those instances when they weren't connected, provide them with support when the economy ebbed and flowed. We have to now recognize that we still have those same needs as a society to create permanence and stability for people. But the way we refashion those support mechanisms, the way we create new organizations, new employee organizations, the way we rethink so many of our public policies and institutional arrangements have to be within the context of this changing economy. So if employees are going to move from job to job, we have to rethink our employment policies in this country. We have to rethink our benefit plans in this country. We have to rethink a whole range of social insurance programs that help to incentivize mobility and help provide support to people as they move from job to job. Also, we have to think about how our benefit plans can be portable so that people remain with one plan as they move from place to place. So from a public policy perspective, we really need to update and reconfigure so much of our social insurance programs based on labor market mobility. On the other side of the aisle, organizationally, labor organizations and employee associations have to think differently about how they represent the voice of employees in a growing individualized employment contract. And that means new models of representation. That means new ways of reaching out and communicating with people. But I think the answer to how we provide support for people in this new economy is the same way we did it in the old economy. Strong public policy and organizations that create popular voice for people to have a say in their workplace and in their community and the halls of government. I think unions are as relevant today as they were. And our need to restore public policies are as critical to our success as they once were as well.
Mm-hmm. For some time, there was this notion in management circles that employees were valuable members of the firm and that, that there was a sort of, idea of taking care of people. It sounds to me like that is no longer even, there's no even longer even any pretense of that in these high-tech firms, and that in what all the things that you're describing, portable benefits and things that allow people mobility as they move from job to job. I believe that one of the things that was mentioned last night in your lecture is that the average tenure of a job in California is now 3 years. This obviously raises a host of issues. If it's not going to be the firm that does it, and presumably, the traditional unions often did these things, but perhaps is no longer the case, at least in the high-tech areas. You think that that can be changed over the next few years or something. But where do these kinds of support systems come from if this new social contract is going to happen?
Well, you really raise two points. One is the impact of loyalty on production and on employee satisfaction. And then the second issue you raise is how do we create new kinds of health portable benefit plans? Where does that come from? On the question of loyalty, let me answer that part first. I think one of the strongest impetuses for bringing the employer community to the table to rethink the need for our changing employment policies is because it will become increasingly difficult for employers to get the best of employees when employees increasingly feel more loyalty to their Rolodex and their social networks than they do to their employer. And this is a problem for industries that depend on the best and the brightest of people and depend on people to do more than just perform a simple task, but to really give it their all when they come to work. And in order for people to want to give it their all and feel pride in their job, they have to have some notion of reliance with that firm. Firms increasingly can't create that notion of reliance because of the volatility in the global economy and therefore the need for having some permanent relationship to an entity that bargains with that employer eventually will become in the interest of the employer the same way it is to an employee. In some ways, that will be this problem that the labor movement solves that neither industry nor government can solve on its own. And that's why we came into being in the first place. We solved a different set of problems in the 1930s that neither government nor industry could solve on their own. So on the loyalty question, it will be very important for these firms who depend on the best and the brightest of people to figure out new ways for building a notion of reliance. That's one point. The second point about how will we create the benefit plans for employees, I think it's a combination of we need massive, massive reform in our in HMO reform, in insurance, in our insurance programs. We have to figure out new ways to constitute group rates. What's the group rate for thousands of temporary workers that work on an individual basis yet are in the same occupation? So we have to figure out new ways to create group rates for people. We have to figure out ways to reform ERISA so that people can take their pension and move it from job to job. That doesn't mean that the firm doesn't contribute to these benefits. What it means is that the benefit is connected to me, and as I move from job to job, my employer makes a contribution. I'm not saying that we shift the responsibility away from the employer. They still need to contribute, but it's unlikely that they will be that they will carry the policies per se, and it may be some other entity that does, and the employer simply makes a contribution.
Very good. We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation, and let me also reintroduce our guest this morning. We're talking with Amy Dean. She's president of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council in San Jose, California, and she's been organizing there for some years, and she's here on the campus to speak last night in a Millicom lecture, and we're talking with her on Focus 580 about organizing labor and dealing with the demands of the high-tech economy and sharing prosperity across the board. Any questions on those areas are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And you'll need to put on those headphones to hear the calls here. Let's talk with a listener in Peoria on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. Caterpillar Tractor Company now is manufacturing a tractor in St. Petersburg, Russia, because these small tractors, you know, the Russians got little pieces of land. They don't need a big tractor. And this way, the small tractor will make money for Caterpillar and no union. Now, a couple of years ago, my son works at Caterpillar, and they wanted to send him to Brazil. But he didn't want to go because he was building a new home, and his wife was about to have a baby, so he didn't go. Now, right now, they're setting up factories in Korea, Japan, China, and a lot of other foreign countries to compete against the American worker. Now, who's going to buy these products when we have people in those countries that are working for all the way from 50 cents an hour to $2 a day?
Well, I think you point out, sir, one of the great ironies behind the advocates of the free trade or unfair trade efforts in our country. On the one hand, the whole notion behind creating unfettered or uninhibited trade arrangements is so that we could open up markets and supposedly increase consumption in the countries that we're opening up the markets in. But what we know and from experience is that really what we're doing is we're creating situations where we produce and turn the product right back around and bring it back to our own domestic market, or we send it out to another country that can't afford to buy the product. We are not creating middle-class economies. We're creating turnkey operations so that we can get cheap labor. And I think it gets down to the issue of it's not a question of should we or shouldn't we have open trade relations across borders. Those days are never turning back. We are fully integrated into a world economy. We can't ignore it. The question really is, under what terms and conditions do we create our trade relationships? And unless we have ways to ensure that our political values extend to the countries that we trade with and that the countries we trade with have free democratic institutions, there will be no way to really fulfill the real goal of trade, which is to create middle-class sectors of the economy in these countries so that there can be markets for us to sell products to.
Yeah, but in this country with inflation of 4%, they want the laboring people to work for less. Now, in those other countries, they don't have inflation because the people can't buy anything anyway.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Other callers are welcome during this hour. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you, in terms of the international trade agreements, I think that many people in the labor movements have been very disappointed with the record of the Clinton administration, as many trade agreements have been consummated during his terms. And I believe the AFL-CIO has essentially endorsed Al Gore as presidential candidate. And I'm wondering if you have reason for optimism that he might take a different tack on these issues.
I don't want to in any way create anti-romantic notion about what it will take to put social issues on the table in our trade arrangements. At the same time, and I am convinced in the absence of a broad-based social movement like what we hopefully saw was the beginning of in Seattle, these issues will not be on the table. Bill Clinton, until Seattle took place, refused to ever even put on the table any discussion about human rights or the environment, even if they were to be weak ones. There was no legitimate place to have those conversations. I think the difference with Al Gore is he will create a legitimate internal mechanism for having those conversations. Does that mean that our activity on the street will have to stop to create the political space and will for real reform? Absolutely not. But we will be at the table. But that is only useful if it's in partnership with a much broader social movement and agenda that really heats up the country around this issue. We are up against so much influential power of capital on this whole keep the borders open and unfettered and not bring any of our values to the table. That this is an enormous fight. It's a fight of David and Goliath. It's one that can be won. Al Gore being the president is a component to creating the political space and will. But there's a whole other piece to the equation, which is a mass movement in this country demanding that economic justice and equity and human rights be civil rights issues as part of our trade agreements.
Very good. We have another call to talk with in Belgium. Let's go to them. Line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Going to a point that you were at before the previous caller, you were talking about mobility of benefits and mobility of the workforce. And California being a prime example of this, of people moving around a great deal in jobs and in their personal lives also, causes a great deal of problems within the family. In that, if you transplant people from one side of the country to the other, from one side of the state to the next, from one school to the next, you start affecting the family greatly. And that is probably one of the major problems we're probably going to have to face in the future with this mobile economy we have. The family values break down. We begin to have all kinds of social problems at the very basis of our culture. And even though as ethnically different as our culture may be, the family is always the most important aspect of it.
Well, I think you make a great point, sir, and the fact that our work week is extending in these industries and that it really has become a 24-hour workplace. In these major information technology firms, it is 24 hours around the clock. You have operations all around the world, and really the workday has become so extended that it not only affects our family lives, but it's also affecting civic life, and that people have no disposable time to think beyond anything but their own immediate interests of survival. This has enormous implications for our democracy as well as the impact to our families. This is a huge problem. Now, as to the issue, and so let me just conclude the point by saying bargaining for quality of life and organizing for quality of life issues will be as important as quantity of life issues, if not more so. On the question of mobility, when I think about labor markets and the need for flexibility within them and the new kinds of intermediary institutions that can help do that for both industry as well as for employees, I'm thinking more about mobility within a region, that when you have a concentration of industry and and clusters of firms housed within a region, that the mobility is over multiple firms but within a more concentrated geography. That's not to say that what you are talking about isn't likely, but when we talk about mobility, I'm more referring to mobility across firms in a single geography more so than, you know, kind of bouncing around across the country.
I see. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We're about at our midpoint with Amy Dean, president of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council in San Jose, California, someone who has been called the Mother Jones of Silicon Valley. I think the New York Times even suggested she might be the most innovative figure in Silicon Valley. That's quite a statement. And we're talking about labor issues in the new economy. We have a couple callers waiting. We'd welcome others, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. We'll go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I tuned in late, so you may have touched on what I want to talk about and the question that I want to ask. And that is that it seems pretty obvious to me that these transnational businesses, in conducting their businesses, owe no allegiance to the nation state, the United States in our particular case, and therefore are subversive of the nation state. Seems to me that the labor union movement has to create an argument and tie in its position and base its position on the maintenance of the nation state, and in that way weakened this global movement, this global economy, which is subversive to the average worker.
We did answer that. Thank you very much. No, I'm kidding. we have that figured out. No, you make a great point, and I think it's an obvious point, but it's not often made enough, which is the biggest challenge for us with our trade policies. Again, this is not to make the case for rolling back, opening our borders, but we have this huge problem. We talked about this last night, which is this is the first time where we've extended our economic borders but have not co-extended our political borders. And as a consequence, we have, our economic interests reigning. And this is such a departure from economic policy that we pursued in this country, you know, really up until the 1980s. I mean, economic policy was always a vehicle for achieving social and political goals and aspirations. It never was a goal in and of itself. Competitiveness has become a goal in and of itself under the assumption that if we create competitiveness, we all benefit. And we see this playing out in our trade agreements, where we think that if we just create more opportunity for investment and more opportunity for capital, then we'll all benefit. But in the absence of extending our political values and having some having institutions that ensure our values are in balance with economic trends, what's happening in the new economy, what's happening in the global economy will not benefit all of us in a way we need to be benefited. So there is no question that as we gear our organizing around the global economy, that we have to call for sanctions and accountability of nations. There's a big debate going on, though, I think, in the activist world between do you hold corporations accountable, do you hold countries accountable? I don't think it's either or. I think it's got to be both. We can't be willing to cede the fact that nation states have political obligations and jurisdictions. We're not moving towards some international regulatory framework anytime soon. So we must absolutely ensure that there's accountability of nations as well as corporations when there are violations of certain human rights issues that we need to make part of the trade debate.
Can I go a little further on that?
Go ahead.
And that is that along these lines, it seems to me that the labor movement very early in the game, that is during the New Deal, adopted the policy of the New Deal and became internationalists. And at this point, internationalism has become a fetish, and it's tied the hands of the labor movement to such an extent that it doesn't really recognize yet the necessity for tying its interests in with the national government in the United States or in Europe or whatever, and therefore this international outlook, which is now a fetish in many ways, is self-destructive.
I'm not sure what the internationalist perspective. I mean, I'm not sure exactly where you're going with that.
Well, the argument among the globalists, that is the transnational corporations, is that you have to get rid of all these national boundaries and let trade go whichever way it will go. And this, of course, it's obvious to me at least that it destroys whatever contracts and whatever activities unions want to, under the present system at least, want to pursue. The unions have no power to maintain any argument because the transnational corporations are so powerful and the governments the national government of the United States is an ally of these commercial interests and disregards the interests of workers and other things, like the ecosystem and so on.
Well, I think under the leadership of John Sweeney, there is an attempt to really begin making inroads in this whole question of how do we build more solidarity across labor movements around the world. But I also think we're at the very beginning of the stages of this work. I think, you know, we should see our work as kind of the pioneers in this area. And I think John Sweeney, you know, recognizes the Cold War is over. He is retooled and brought on a whole set of new people to run what is now called the Solidarity Center, whose mission is to create relationships and ties across trade union movements around the world so we can have more cooperation around bargaining and other kinds of international solidarity support. At the same time that's happening, John Sweeney in the American labor movement is making the issue of trade that works for working families a priority. I do think, though, that we have to look at the work. We're really at the beginning, and those of us who are engaged in this work and trying to build common standards are really we're pioneers in many respects, because we don't have precedent for how to ensure political values are a part of our trade agreements to this scale. So I don't think there's absolutely a blueprint figured out yet, but I do think the kinds of things that we're working on are steps in the right direction.
Hope that gets the caller's question. We have a couple people waiting. We'll go on to next, a listener in Urbana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I had heard you mention Al Gore earlier, and I was just concerned, you know, for 8 years we haven't heard Al or Mr. Gore, Vice President Gore, say anything about, you know, the economic bill of rights for all workers, whether it's jobs for all or living wages or a 30-hour work week. Or we haven't really heard him say anything even in the latest Teamster convention on labor law reform. And I was wondering, has he actually said anything that does create the beginning that we need for labor workers in the U.S., or is he just another corporate person, not just stating some of the obvious stuff, and is not going to tell us the workers' Bill of Rights or strong penalties for breaking labor laws or any of the other reforms that are needed? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, let me answer your question in three parts. First, you know as I know that large financial interests control both parties, and that the emerging high-tech companies actually have a closer relationship to the Democratic Party than they do the Republican Party. Having said that, Al Gore has certainly made a lot more overtures to us about the needs to have workers have the right to organize unfettered and unhampered with by the employer. When he accepted his endorsement of the AFL-CIO, he said, "I recognize that workers do not have the right to organize in this country, and we need to ensure that employers do not interfere." Now, having said that, that's simply a great beginning point. And all that means, sir, is that the door's been open. And that means that the rest of us in the labor movement, in the social justice movement, civil rights organizations, we have to go to work. And we need to spend the next 8 years making this issue, the rights for employees to have voice at work, unfettered by their employer, the civil rights issue of our day. And absent us making that issue and being out on the streets over that issue and demanding equity, I don't care who's sitting in the presidential seat, there will be nobody who gets elected to this country who both gets elected and makes massive reform absent the work that we must all do to create the political space and will for it to happen.
Let me just ask a quick follow-up, then I'll go on to our next caller. But a lot of people that I talk to about the candidates in front of us for the presidential election, a lot of people are leaning toward Ralph Nader. And I'm wondering, what's wrong with Ralph Nader? I mean, he does say a lot of things that a lot of people really feel strongly about that Al Gore is not saying. And so I think there are a lot of people feeling like they're tired of just simply, stopping themselves from wasting their vote. They're just going to, if that's what they're doing, that's fine, but they're going to vote their conscience.
Well, to answer your question, what's wrong with Ralph Nader? There's nothing wrong with Ralph Nader, and absolutely Ralph Nader is raising the right kinds of issues and questions. And what his candidacy represents is the fact that the Democratic Party has not allowed important issues around, for example, trade and rights of the environment and the rights of human beings to have parity with the rights of compact discs. And nowhere is there that conversation taking place within our party. And as a consequence, it is forcing people out because we're not creating legitimate mechanisms to have that conversation internally. So it's important to be able to recognize that there are conversations that increasingly people are frustrated about not taking place in legitimate channels. But the fact is that one of two people are going to win the election come the day after in November. It's either going to be George Bush or Al Gore. And I'm not saying that Al Gore is going to be the answer again. And I've said this repeatedly today. I said it last night. We elect people not as an end in and of itself. We elect the right person who has as close to our values as possible, who will at least let us get in the door. And all that simply does is then create the space for us to do our work and to build organization and to build loud and smart voices about what kinds of reforms are needed. And one of those two people will be elected, and our chances to bring about that kind of reform is far greater with an Al Gore presidency than a George Bush. So it's not to say that there's anything wrong with Ralph Nader. He's raising issues that are not being addressed by the Democratic Party. It's important to have that kind of conversation going on. I think the problem is that it will not happen anytime soon in my lifetime or yours where we're going to have anything but a two-party system. And so long as that exists, we have to not only marry the candidate with that shares our values the most, but also the candidate that's the most viable. And again, recognizing that putting that person in office is not the end of the game.
Very good. We'll
it's
go on.
The beginning.
Okay. We'll go on next to a listener in Champaign County on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, good morning. Hear, hear to that. Nader is even talking about harvesting votes in the areas where there's a great gap in the polls. And I think victory for him is a good 5% nationwide, and a victory for us, actually, and some kind of legacy of a continued movement that would continue to put those issues on the table. But Illinois is pretty close right now, so I'm anyway, more on that another day, perhaps. I wanted to ask from the very beginning about this idea of the portable health plan and this that unions could be doing this. It seems to me there's a good example of a portable health plan in Canada, and that would be the thing to do, and that way we're not dividing people. You know, we have people with golden parachutes, and we have people with gold-plated health care plans, and then we have people who have the lousiest health care in any of the developed countries. That's one issue. The other issue is the corporatization of the universities, and that may be too much of a digression right now, but as campuses, corporate campuses look more and more like campuses, and this campus looks more and more like a research park, it seems to me that we have to look at those issues as well. And that may be for another day, and maybe the GEO people are starting to develop those kind of arguments. But thanks for your efforts, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you. And I think there is a relationship to what we're talking about today as it relates to some of the trends that are taking place in our institutions of higher education. As we shift more toward distance learning and shift away from the classroom and direct human contact with teachers, as increasingly we see not educators running departments but administrators who are simply managing departments, this is a concern. And as we wrestle with the tension to produce young people who are marketable in the economy versus kids who are also prepared to be stewards of civil society, and as we wrestle with that tension and the changes that are going on in the university, it has enormous implications for our ability to make the kinds of reforms that we've been all talking about over this last hour and many things we talked about last night. Because universities play such an important role in creating the public space for conversation. They create such an important role in creating the public space for activism. If the youth of our nation are not our conscience, then who is? And if we take away the place for where that can develop and grow, then we take apart and unravel an enormously huge asset to balancing the political debate and landscape within our nation.
We have another caller waiting and just about 10 minutes left with our guest, Amy Dean. She's president of the South Bay Labor Council, AFL-CIO, in San Jose, California. And we're talking about a wide variety of issues pertaining to labor and the new economy. If you'd like to join us in the remaining 10 minutes, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Kankakee next on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, just to, number one, say that I appreciate this program in the mornings. Jack, you and David Inge do a wonderful job on Focus 580. Just a general comment on the general state of relations between management and labor. I don't know if Ms. Dean has recently tried to hire an electrician or a plumber or maybe a contractor to do some remodeling at her house.
No, the only remodeling going on in my home is being done by my husband or I.
Well, I would suggest that in this particular area that labor holds tremendous sway at this time and probably has for the last 10, 15 years. In our area, we have many electricians, plumbers, whatever, basically dictating their terms of wages and pensions. mainly because there is such demand for these skilled people. I also noticed that there's tremendous demand for truck drivers in our country. Last year, 400,000 vacancies. I guess what I'm getting at is my sense is there's a certain amount of denigration of the current labor management relations, and yet I see that there are probably more power now in the hands of skilled people as far as negotiating terms and conditions of employment than there has been in my lifetime. And I look at the rate of home ownership in this country, up to 67%, the highest it's ever been. I guess I'm trying to understand exactly where you're coming from and what you're going to do to improve upon these current situation. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thanks for the call.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me try to take the best stab at it that I can. You're absolutely right that skilled labor and for the construction trades, that they have incredible bargaining power these days, given that labor markets are so tight and their ability to be able to, a labor's ability to move from job to job if they don't like the conditions in one site and move to another is terrific. At the same time, if we're not taking advantage of those opportunities to form organizations so that when the economy does ebb, as it inevitably will, then we have protections during those periods where things aren't as good as they are now. As to home ownership, I'm not sure where your statistic comes from, but everything I've seen is that home ownership is on the decline. And if you look at my home city that I come from in San Jose, California, the heart of the new economy, a regional economy with unprecedented prosperity that's fueling the rest of the country and much of the world's prosperity, home ownership is on the decline. And over 50% of families of four cannot afford to purchase a home. What's happening is that because the economy looks more and more like an hourglass, as we talked about, with lots of high-paying people at the top, a huge proliferation of low-wage service sector dead-end jobs at the bottom with very little in between, it's the high end of the economy that's got enormous disposable income that's putting down cash to buy plots of land, rebuilding houses, and driving up the bottom of the labor market. So it's really the high end of the hourglass that's driving up the housing market at the bottom. So home ownership, for the most part, is down. I'm not sure what you're referring to. As to what I am going to do about any of that, my feeling is no one person does much about anything in the world. It's really about people working together to make a difference that can rebalance politics, can rebalance the economy. Working people do not have the same voice in their workplace, in their communities, and in their halls of government that they once did. I single-handedly will not change that or bring that about to imbalance. But those of us working together will and need to, because many, many, many people depend on our ability to be successful.
Let me ask you to say something about home ownership for working people in San Jose. What is the scenario there?
What I just talked about, which is the majority over, first of all, median household a median price of a house when on New Year's Eve or the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, a median household price for a home was $400,000. Today, it's $550,000. Mm-hmm. That is well out of the range of your average working family of four. And over 50% of families of four cannot afford home ownership in the Valley. And again, it speaks to this hourglass and the high end of the labor market having enormous disposable income and being able to pay cash for houses driving up the whole bottom of the market so that you've got little bungalows, 2-3-bedroom bungalows that are going for $400,000 or $500,000 a pop. And so as a result, it's pushing lots of people out of home ownership. It's also impacting the rental market in that the average one-bedroom apartment is now going for $1,500 a month, well out of the range of your average working person. So, and I don't think that's just happening in San Jose or Silicon Valley. It's the whole Bay Area. It's the whole California labor market. It's the West Coast we're seeing it happen in lots of places where, you know, there's industries that are driving up the high end of the housing market.
One of the things that you were involved in successfully passing a living wage ordinance in San Jose, I wonder if you could talk about that.
We worked for many years to create a requirement that when municipal contracts were let through the city of San Jose, that there would be a living wage attached to that, so that when vendors would bid on contracts, assuming all things were equal and each vendor met the technical aspects of the bid, those vendors that could pay a set living wage, which is now $11.15, would be eligible for the contract. And the important point of this is to ensure that the public investments that we make to purchase services or to invest in other things with our public resources be used to support living wage jobs and not subsidize jobs that don't allow people to live at a living wage.
The other thing that is ongoing now, I believe, is an effort to get health insurance for all children within the county. Can you talk about what's going on with that?
Sure. This is a really exciting effort, and it flows out of the activist base that we've been trying to cultivate and build over the years as we have more and more people working together around a common vision of economic justice in our valley. We have worked post-living wage to kind of create something called an economic blueprint, which is a set of policy recommendations to advance equity when elected officials make decisions on anything from public investments to land use. All the different levers public officials have at their disposal, we want to advance equity criteria or measures into those decisions. One of the first initiatives or flagships of that blueprint was to take the tobacco settlement monies that so many cities and counties and state governments are now receiving and use that to develop a program to subsidize both the premium pay for poor kids as well as to create a new product for the kids of working poor families who don't qualify for any kind of state or federal insurance program but still don't have enough money to pay the premiums. And so we're two-thirds of the way there of winning a political battle as well as funding to raise the $11 million that we need. And we believe we'll be successful. The city of San Jose is the last jurisdiction to vote on $2 million for us for our program, and that will help close the gap for what we need to get this off the ground. And we will be the first county in the country to make health insurance universally accessible and affordable to all of our children under age 18. And we ought to be the place where it starts because it's the place where there is the most wealth and prosperity. And if we can't do it in Silicon Valley, where can it be done?
We just have a minute and a half left. I wondered if you wanted to say anything about working partnerships and also if you want to give out the web address and so forth.
Yeah, I'd be happy to say just a few words. Working Partnerships was formed in 1995, 5 years ago, as an organization that works very closely with the Labor Council, a policy and research organization that marries policy and research to advocacy and organizing, really in an attempt to bring a much wider range of voices to the table around economic decision-making within our jurisdiction. I think what is representative of this organization is that it's a different kind of social change organization and that it marries research and technical capacity with good old grassroots organizing. And the next generation of social justice organizations, if we are to be successful and take on some of the big forces that we have to win against, then we have to be just as smart as we are loud. And so not only do we have to be very skilled at moving lots of people to action and exciting people to get involved, but at the same time, we have to have the research and technical capacity to make the case that what we're asking for and what we're demanding is both right but also smart.
Okay. And did you want to give out the URL for that for folks?
www.atwork.org. And likely that's not up to date because we are activists.
Okay.
Feel free to dial up.
Okay. Well, we're here at the end of our time. And I have to apologize to a couple of listeners who we didn't include in the conversation. Sorry we ran out of time. But we'll continue to talk about these issues. And hopefully you'll have another chance to talk with us then. And to our guest, Amy Dean, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Jack.